You're listening to the Diplomats Podcast on Asian Geopolitics. As always, I'm your host, Ankit Panda, recording from Washington, D.C.
And I'm your co-host, Katie Putz, coming to you also from Washington, D.C.
Well, Katie, you've just come back from Asia. Tell us a little bit about where you were.
Yeah, so I just returned from a trip to Thailand. I was in Chiang Mai for the Asia-Pacific Feminist Forum, which is it was envisioned as a tri-annual event, so every 3 years, by the Asia-Pacific Forum on Women, Law, and Development. But it was last held in 2017, so it was quite an event, gathering of Asian feminists.
Yeah, I think it's been a while on the podcast since we've talked about issues sort of pertaining to gender or race, which certainly we have discussed in the past. But I thought this would be a great chance to reflect a little bit on women's movements and feminist movements more generally around Asia, because it's not something we talk about too much on the Geopolitics podcast. And of course, across the region we cover here at The Diplomat, you definitely have a patchy record on women in leadership roles, women's rights more generally. So who were really the participants at this forum? Were these mostly activists, political figures, journalists, kind of a mix of all of the above?
So it was predominantly activists. So the APWLD is a network of more than 320, I believe it is, organizations from 31 countries and territories in Asia. This forum had about 500 attendees. Most of them were activists from these member organizations, as well as journalists. The APWLD has a journalist fellowship, and so there was a network of feminist journalists there also. And so it was a really, really diverse setting. It was interesting for me. There were not a lot of Americans. The United States is not part of this, the geographical coverage area of this network. So it was unique for me to be one of the only Americans in the room, and also to be one of the only white people in a room, which I think was a good but unique experience.
So in terms of the overall scope of the region, were sort of, you know, did this encompass everything from kind of Central Asia to the Pacific Islands? You know, you said that, I guess, you're one of the only white people there. So I'm guessing you didn't really see too many, I guess, white Australians or white New Zealanders kind of attending this. Is that generally right?
Yeah. So there were some New Zealanders, I believe some Australians. But as I said, the United States is not a member organization. But there were feminists from Kyrgyzstan, all the way to Fiji, the Philippines, Indonesia, basically every country in Asia, with a couple of exceptions. And this is something that I wrote about in an article recently. The APWLD does not actually include Afghanistan, which I think is an interesting and frankly not a good geographic choice to include everything up to Pakistan and then also Central Asia, but leave out Afghanistan. But I think part of the issue there is a functional one. There are not feminist movements in Afghanistan, organized feminist movements in Afghanistan. And so to participate in a network that is built of organizations, you kind of need an organization. Similarly, there were, to my knowledge, there were no Turkmen organizations present. There were no North Korean organizations present. And I think this is something when we talk about feminist organizing in Asia, you have to first be able to organize in order to feminist organize.
Right, right. And so, you know, some of the themes that you wrote about, and yeah, for listeners, Katie did write an excellent article on this particular meeting that goes over many of the themes and sort of talks about the participants. So if you're interested, go check that out for sure. What were sort of some of the themes that you found kind of striking, Katie? Because it was interesting, you know, there's a lot going on here, certainly kind of critiques of defense spending, defense industrial spending in particular, a little bit of a critique of the United States too, in some contexts. But what were sort of some of the issues that started to verge on many of the questions we talk about regularly on this podcast?
Yeah, I mean, so I think maybe just to dial back for our listeners who maybe are not so versed in feminism, or really just like know feminism is a word, but don't necessarily know much about feminism
as
a series of movements. You know, feminism is this range of sociopolitical movements and ideologies that really aim to define and establish the political, economic, social equality of the sexes. It is not an attempt to replace the patriarchy with a matriarchy. It's really a focus on that equality. And so it also brings in a number of other movements related to other marginalized people. So there were trans activists at this organization, a lot of indigenous activists. And so the idea of equality is really at the center of this. That said, there's a lot of ways we can think of achieving equality. And so there's so much diversity in the approaches that different feminist movements take. And I think a good example of this is you have more radical feminist movements. You have large protests and sort of agitating for change. But you also have what one of the Central Asian participants explained to me as transformative feminism, which is more working within a system that exists to educate people about their rights and about accessing their rights and sort of moving change in a more gradual way. And all of this is encompassed in this. And sort of the value of an event like this is all these different groups with their different cultural contexts and their different experiences that are never going to match up exactly can sort of talk to each other and learn from the experiences of these other groups.
And so there's, I think there's a case we made that a lot of this really falls under the banner of human security, which I think, especially, you know, when you look at the divergent levels of development across the Asia Pacific, the issues that I think various feminist organizers and groups are interested in from country to country can often vary, where in certain more developed countries, the issues that, you know, you might be interested in include things like, you know, childcare, labor force participation for women, work protections. But then in some of the less developed societies with, I guess, more intense patriarchal cultures, it's often just even, you know, the right to work in the first place or the ability to really be people in public society, right? So how did that dynamic play out at a conference like this? Because I can imagine, you know, there being, obviously, I think it's difficult for organizers when you're bringing together so many diverse groups to sort of manage some of those things. So how did that go down?
Yeah, so I think, and the organizers did not try to sort of distill everybody into the same message, because that's not really the point.
Right.
I think when sort of looking at how this was organized, it was sort of organized over the course of 3 days. The main focus was on exploring feminist world building, and we sort of started with these plenary sessions that had sometimes provocative speeches. You know, the one that focused, one woman focused on militarism and really kind of came after the United States, and I think a not inappropriate way for sort of being at the center of militarism in the world. You know, if you look at the largest defense contractors in the world and the people who benefit from conflicts are certainly defense contractors, a lot of these are American companies. And I think that creates some uncomfortable questions that I think are worth wrestling with. But the forum sort of focused on where we are, where we want to be, and then how we get there. And I think when I look back at sort of who the speakers were, you had, you know, there was a speaker from South Korea who talked about the backlash to feminist movements and organizing. There was a speaker from the Northern Mariana Islands who talked about sort of securitization and sort of the fact that in a lot of these Pacific islands, their strategic location is the thing that is the only thing that matters to the rest of the world. But the people there don't really have much of a say in missile testing in their own waters. And so but then each day, the afternoon, there were dozens of workshops that sort of focused on a whole host of things. There was one on Central Asian migrant workers. There was one on Muslim activists in India, sort of operating under sort of Hindutva ideology. There was one on navigating, you know, legal landscapes for women human rights defenders. And so there's just such a diversity of things. And they did not try to sort of simplify this into one message. But I do still think that there is this overarching message of creativity and thought, in the sense that the way the world exists currently is not the way it always has to exist, or it has always existed, and that there are sort of these modes of thinking that we can kind of break out of. And it does sound a little bit like flu, I think, sometimes, but, you know, the idea that we don't have to be defined by the current systems that exist, because these things have not always existed, and the future is something that can engender change.
Mm-hmm. So the last question I have is kind of one that I sort of read about, but I don't actually fully understand, but, you know, it definitely seems concerning. So you sort of see this global trend, particularly in a lot of democracies. So in Asia, I think, I think you see evidence for this in South Korea, in India, in parts of Southeast Asia, to an extent, maybe in Australia as well. But it's generally the role of, I guess, gender-based polarization in domestic politics, right? So you have, especially among younger cohorts, you do kind of see men and women very much polarized on a lot of issues. And particularly for the men, there's the rise of kind of misogyny as a political force, right, which was pretty instrumental, for instance, in the last South Korean presidential election when, you know, the president was, presidential candidates were campaigning on abolishing the Ministry for Gender Equality. I'm wondering if that sort of came up at all. Obviously, an issue also here, I know there weren't too many Americans and not everything's about the United States, but obviously a dynamic that's at play in the U.S. election as well. I'm wondering if that was something you sensed in the room that was kind of an issue of interest.
Yeah, you know, I think it's interesting. I think for some men, discussions of feminism sort of bring up these feelings of there's just a bunch of women in a room talking about how much they hate men. That is not something I witnessed to any degree. To the contrary, like I sort of said when I was explaining feminism, I think there is this sense that to be feminist is to be anti-man. And that's not true. I mean, many of the women at this conference have husbands, they have sons. This is sort of the same argument that I think male politicians sometimes make. I have daughters, of course I love women. But, you know, that's not the purpose. The purpose is sort of envisioning a better future for everyone. I do think there is this fundamental tension though, because certainly some men view greater participation of women in political spaces, for example, in a zero-sum way. If you have 100 senators and you want more of them to be women, that means less of them have to be men. And so there is this kind of precarity, I think, which is absurd. Men continue to hold most of the power in the world. And so, you know, edging into that, I think is totally fair, but also I'm a woman who wants to edge into that. But I do think we do see this tension break into that domestic political sphere. You mentioned South Korea. We certainly see this in the United States. I think it does come from this sense of insecurity that some men have, that if women have more control and more power, then that means I personally have less. That's not what feminists are trying to achieve, but that is what I think a lot of men sort of stuck in these patriarchal systems and sort of deeply stewing in misogyny think is going to happen. I can tell you that's not what the women at this event were discussing. Or, you know, we did not have a little like seance at the end to sort of like voodoo doll all the men in our lives. Instead, it was more about sort of uplifting everyone so that there is a more equal society that ultimately does benefit everybody.
Well, thanks, Katie. I think this is certainly not a topic we usually touch on the podcast, but I think certainly really, really important and interesting given your recent travel. So good to talk about this.
Yeah, thank you so much. And before we close out, though, I think we should do one more topic we need to cover, and that is Biden's hot mic moment after the Quad summit. I know that you had some thoughts on this, and I was traveling, so I totally missed it. So please tell me what happened, why this is interesting.
Yeah. So. Yeah, just to kind of throw in, I guess, a few observations on this at the end. Biden's about to leave the White House. He's not up for re-election. And so there is one last Quad summit. The Quad has been really important to the Biden administration. So this is Biden hosting the leaders of Japan, India, and Australia in Delaware at his home. It's the first time he's done this during his presidency. And so, you know, there's been a lot of hand-wringing about the Quad, right? China has said the Quad is, the Quad, among many other things, is part of a U.S. effort to set up an Indo-Pacific NATO. It's all about China. And the Biden administration has repeatedly said the Quad is not about China. Like Jake Sullivan, Biden's national security advisor, repeatedly in the lead-up to this meeting, literally said the Quad isn't about any other country. It's not directed at any other country. And so, you know, you referenced this hot mic moment. And so Biden, who, of course, seems to particularly have an issue with these kinds of moments, was talking, and reporters could hear him talking about China. And so Biden was talking about China's behavior in the South China Sea. Apparently, he described this as a change in tactic, not a change in strategy. And Biden was talking about China's aggressive behavior in the South China Sea and East China Sea. And of course, when these moments were captured and reported, they immediately kind of caused this aha moment, right? You had a spokesperson for the Chinese Foreign Ministry react, saying, you know, we told you so. They say it's not about China, but really they're going to all these summits, closing the doors and talking about China. And so it's funny, right? Because the Biden administration stopped calling the Quad a quadrilateral security dialogue. They sort of just called it the Quad. In some ways, they even styled it with all caps. It was like Q-U-A-D, Quad, which is really strange. But I mean, this moment, I think, is pretty funny. I mean, frankly, just this idea that, you know, the Quad leaders were not talking about China, which I think everybody kind of understood implicitly. I mean, this has basically been happening with almost all American high level summits with like-minded countries, where maybe the final statement will include something on China or include something about, you know, the rules-based order that's really about China. But usually it's not this clear. And I think it's just kind of this funny moment that captures many of the, I guess, contradictions in how a lot of what the U.S. is doing strategically in the Indo-Pacific is being presented to China.
Yeah. And even if something isn't just about China, it can also be partially, at least some, about China. It's hard to talk about Asia without China, right? So, like, you know, of course the Quad is about China, but it's not just about China, I think, is the hope. But
well, right. I mean, you know, it can be about China and be significantly far away from anything resembling an Indo-Pacific NATO, which I think is kind of the medium here, right? I think you'd have to be fairly credulous to take the American statement that the Quad is not about any other country at face value. It clearly is about many of these anxieties. And look, I think the big difference between the Trump approach, I mean, look, the Quad's been around since 2007 on a big hiatus between 2007, 2017, essentially. Under Trump, it was a lot more securitized overtly. And the Biden folks have essentially tried to turn the Quad into a way for these four countries to show that they have alternative offerings to what China offers the region. And they focus on kind of, you know, climate change, vaccines, space security and sustainability, all of these kind of softer issues that don't directly pertain to deterrence or military operations in the South China Sea. But clearly, I mean, these opportunities for consultation among the leaders, which is what the summits represent, right? The summits are this new format for the Quad that's taken off recently. That, I think, is kind of the main takeaway here for me, at least.
All right. Well, very interesting.
Great. Well, thanks, Katie. It's good to do this again. We will be back soon with more. In the meantime, if you've listened to the podcast for a while but you haven't yet subscribed, please do so. And if you've been a subscriber and a listener for a while and you haven't reviewed the show, please do that as well. Really helps us out quite a bit. And as always, if you have suggestions for future coverage, do reach out to either myself or Katie, and we'll be very happy to take that into consideration. Thanks a lot for listening, and we'll be back soon with more.